It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about an effort to redesign the city flag of Milwaukee, which has been described by a design expert as a hot mess.
First, there's a lot of talk this week about campus sexual assaults, with news that a Stanford student received only a six-month jail sentence for committing sexual assault.
Here in Wisconsin, Beloit College was reported as having a high rate of sexual assault reports on campus. That's according to the Washington Post. The dean of students there was unavailable for the show today, but has told the Beloit Daily News that the school had made an effort to create awareness of sexual assault, which could lead to a higher percentage of assaults being reported.
Joining us to talk about the issue of campus sexual assaults is Mike Domish, founder and executive director at the Date Safe Project, an organization focused on reducing sexual assault by teaching consent and respect in all sexual relationships. The organization is based here in Wisconsin. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Veronica.
Well, the Washington Post survey ranked Beloit College with the ninth highest rate of sexual assaults per 1,000 students. Now, even looking at that number, which put them in that top 10 list, national statistics indicate that the number of reported rapes is actually much larger than this, and not just at Beloit, but at most or all college campuses. So why do so few rapes get reported?
Well, and that's the key here. When people hear Beloit College and hear those numbers, they go, oh, my gosh, how can this be a university and our state has this big of a problem? If you break down the numbers of the highest reported university in that report, by the way, it would indicate that less than 1% of students would experience a sexual assault, which everybody with common sense knows is clearly inaccurate. So when you look at these numbers, that is the question. What you should be asking is, why aren't these numbers higher as far as why aren't survivors able to come forward? Obviously, nobody wants any sexual assault to happen, but we know they're happening at a much greater rate than what these numbers are showing, which means we are still failing to help survivors come forward. And this past week is a great example of why. What you saw when people look at that case where Brock Turner was sentenced to 6 months and people look closer at the case, they still saw a system that tried to defend Brock Turner by accusing and questioning the survivor's actions and by trying to put the blame on the survivor over and over again. And when people watch media cases and they see that happening, and if you're a survivor, you've just been sexually assaulted, you might question, do I want to go through that? Do I want to put myself through all that for that person to get 6 months, maybe 3 months of actual time? And people go, well, isn't this a rare case? No. This is not that rare, even though people are reacting like they can't believe it. I was doing a live Facebook feed just the other day talking about this case. One of the survivors on the Facebook feed, their perpetrator, their assailant, was also only convicted for 6 months, convicted of sexual assault and only got a six-month sentence, of which they served 3 days. And that was just a person who happened to be on the feed. We've got to make sure that we can show survivors that there's justice for them. When you show survivors there's justice, they're more likely to come forward because, okay, I'm going to get justice. There's going to be closure. But there's much more we also need to do to help survivors come forward.
And do you sense maybe a sea change happening, a shift in the winds here? Because there was such a national outcry about this particular case. Joe Biden, the vice president, wrote the rape survivor a letter, for instance. It's been all over social media, and I wonder if this will make future outcomes shift a little bit. What do you think?
I want to believe that that's true, but history would tell us that we still have a long ways to go before that's going to actually be the truth and the reality of what's going to happen next. Here's what happens. People paint this scene and they watch it with a brush that makes them feel safe. And the way they do that is they say, there's Brock Turner, that monster. And nobody I know would ever do what he did. And as long as people believe that no one they know could ever do that, then they don't actually apply this case to their life. They don't think this could ever happen to someone they know, that they don't think it would happen to them. They don't think anybody they know could ever do this to another person. And therefore, it's a case that outrages them, but doesn't actually become a personal discussion for them, doesn't change the way they view things, doesn't change their behavior. So we want to believe that it will, and I hope it does. And by the way, that letter was sensational. And if people read that letter and have their children read that letter, but the more important letter to read is the survivor's letter in this case. To read that letter, to have everybody have their team to read that letter, is incredibly powerful.
And that has also been getting a lot of press, a lot of people responding emotionally.
That's right. And so the question becomes, will this change things going forward, which is what you asked. The question will become is, will we keep this conversation going? Because if not, then the answer is no. If yes, then we have a chance here for some transformational moments to occur. Typically, as you know, in the news cycle, though, 3 weeks from now, the question will be, will we be talking about bystander intervention, the two that stepped in? Will we be talking about looking out for each other at parties, stopping the perpetrator, the assailant? Or will something have come back onto the newscape? Hopefully we're going to still be talking about it. We've been talking about it for 20 years. So this is not new for a lot of people working on college campuses and working with students who care deeply about this issue. It's just it's hot right now because this case has brought it forth thanks to the strength and the courage of the survivors.
Mike Domish is with us right now. He's the founder and executive director at the Date Safe Project, an organization that focuses on reducing sexual assault by teaching consent and respect in sexual relationships, and talking about the issues that are in the forefront, thanks to the Stanford rape case, also thanks to Washington Post survey results ranking Beloit College with the 9th highest rate of sexual assaults per 1,000 students. And I want to ask you about those numbers, lists like these. We're seeing more transparency being called upon for universities and colleges to list for parents and others to take a look at what the rate of sexual assault or rape might be at that university, at least the reported numbers. But how helpful are lists like these? If you're a parent and you see one, do you think that's good because perhaps this university has a policy that makes it more encouraging for supporters to come forward? Or do you think they're on this list and this is a high number and that might be bad? How do you process it?
So the federal policies and laws that have been put into place to say colleges must report are fantastic. That's wonderful. We need colleges to be held accountable. But these numbers, these reports of this school has this number, it can be incredibly misleading. People can look at the numbers however they want to work for them. Here's what I mean. What you just said is true. Somebody can look at a campus that has a high number of reports. That means people come forward and say they might actually be creating the best environment for survivors to come forward. Because remember, even the number we see on here is less than 1% of their students. Less than 1%. And that's the highest number. So what we're saying is that the highest number on any campus is 1% of students being able to come forward. And so you could look at that and go, well, at least they have closer to 1% than other schools do. That can actually be a sign they're helping support survivors move forward. Others would say, well, we don't know that. It could be that there actually is more sexual assault there. Here's what we know, that by statistics, by research, by me traveling, the number of survivors I meet, that 1 in 5 is the respected, credible number, which means we have less than 1% being reported and 20% occurring. The gap is so huge here that these numbers are not that helpful to a parent looking at a college campus. If a parent's looking at a college campus and going, why might my child go to a safer campus? Look at what education they're providing. Look at how they create an open and safe environment for students to come forward. Look at how they work with the local sexual assault crisis center. More importantly, though, sit down your child, because no campus you're going to send your child to is going to be able to guarantee any level of safety. They can't. So what do you have to do? You want to give your child the ability to know that you're always going to be there for them if something goes wrong. You want to give your child the ability to know their rights, that they have boundaries that should always be respected. You don't want to say to your child, somebody ever touches you, I'm going to kill them, because that's going to stop your child from coming forward. You want to say to your child, somebody ever touches you, I'm here for you, always. And you want to make sure that you create an environment that allows them to come forward to you, tell them their rights when they're on campus, you have the right to come forward. If you don't want to, if you're not ready to talk to the police, know there's a local crisis center who can help you through that process. And you might be more likely to talk to the police if you start with the local sexual assault crisis center, because they have an advocate that can help you. Let them know their rights. Let them know that this is their body, and no one has ever the right to do anything against their will without their consent, so that if anything ever does happen, they can know what happened to me was wrong, versus our culture, which often teaches them, well, what did you do that got to that point, which is awful. It ends up victim blaming. We do not want that to happen.
And Mike, just very briefly, as we wrap up, as you travel the country and you work with students across the country and colleges, what is the best policy for universities to increase reporting and to make it safe for victims of rape?
Educate. And here's what sadly happens on a lot of campuses. Not all. There's some campuses doing incredible work out there, amazing work out there. But what happens is they see the minimum requirements that they have to address to meet federal policies, and they meet the minimum requirements, which means this is not about creating a transformational change in culture. This is about meeting a checklist. That's dangerous. That's not really trying to change anything. That's trying to make sure we don't get in trouble is what that is. All right. And what we want to do is transform culture so that you're going somewhere and a campus believes deeply in your safety. They want to give you education throughout the year. They're willing to invest in this topic as much as they need to create the safest environment for you. That's what we need to see happen. We need to see, by the way, this occur in middle schools and high schools, because universities are only getting what culture is, our society is giving them in the first place. So you need this education to begin so much younger than it is right now.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on, guys.
That was Mike Domish, founder and executive director at the Date Safe Project.
Coming up, we'll hear about an effort to engage Milwaukee's citizens by redesigning the city's flag. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk ice cream and other frozen treats for this week's Food Friday.
First, have you ever seen Milwaukee's city flag? Did you even know the city had a flag? It does, but plenty of people aren't exactly impressed by it. The flag, which was adopted in the 1950s, tries to cram a whole lot of Milwaukee into one design. Here's design expert and flag lover Roman Mars describing Milwaukee's flag in a 2015 TED Talk.
It's a kitchen sink flag. There's a gigantic gear representing industry. There's a ship recognizing the port. A giant stalk of wheat paying homage to the brewing industry. It's a hot mess.
Harsh words for sure. And our next guest thinks Milwaukee can do better when it comes to its flag. Over the last year, he's led an effort to redesign the city flag. It's culminated in a design contest, which got over 1,000 entries for new flags and has now been whittled down to just 5. And the winning entry will be announced on Tuesday. And yes, that is Flag Day.
Steve Kotis joins us now. He's the design director and creative lead at the People's Flag of Milwaukee. He's joining us to talk more about this effort. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we get to the new designs in this context, let's talk about the current flag of Milwaukee. We just heard it described as a hot mess. What do you see when you look at it?
I see a list of inventory from a particular point in Milwaukee's history, more than I do a true symbol of pride and unity.
And why do you think it's important for Milwaukee to have a flag that's well-designed and emblematic of what the city is? Does it matter?
Well, I think this is something we need to see in every city. I mean, as it goes, city flags are meant to represent a city in some sort of symbolic way. And then when we get to the state level, we see that states have flags. And then, of course, you know, countries have flags. So, you know, if we take a really big step back and think about what flags really are, I like to think of them as sort of a universal language, sort of like love, sort of like mathematics. They're universally acknowledged and they're universally sort of agreed upon and used. And so when we get down to the city level, you know, civic pride is something that is good in all places. And that doesn't exclude Milwaukee. So with regard to Milwaukee, I believe that it's a great city and we have a very bright future. And the time has truly come to create a symbol for that and a symbol that pays respect to the past, but ultimately positions us for the future and is flown to show, you know, how much we love this city.
And it sounds like you want to avoid what we just heard described as the kitchen sink approach to flag making. Well, there's breweries, so you have the grain of wheat. You have a baseball stadium, better put that on there, even though it's the one that's closed now. You don't want to have a whole bunch of literal items to describe Milwaukee.
Yeah, so if we get really specific and talk about all the technical things that make flags good, they are, you know, first and foremost, they're meant to be seen from a great distance. So considering that, only simple designs are truly effective as flags. And in the case of Milwaukee, we have a very, you know, literal representation with very specific iconography. And it works well for some sort of fixed medium, such as, you know, a T-shirt design or maybe a mural, something where you can see it, it's stationary, you don't see it from its backside, all of these things. So with that in mind, it really sort of falls short. And in turn, because it's so complex, it's hard to produce. It's hard to produce correct. And what we see now is that there are, you know, when you Google Milwaukee flag, what you're typically seeing is a modern day vectorized version that was recreated from the original flag. And as it goes, because it's so complex, things were lost in translation. And so ultimately, you know, we can't even produce our current city flag the way it was produced back in the 50s. And thus, it never really became a symbol of pride. And up until this last year, I don't think, 75% of Milwaukee or more Milwaukeeans probably didn't even know it existed, because it really doesn't fly around town.
Well, tell us about this design contest and how it got started. Who's been part of it so far?
So after the famous TED Talk came out, which, you know, I was a part of well before the TED Talk came out. So our initiative didn't start because the TED Talk came out. You know, we were already in active talks with Roman Mars, but it really started out as just me. And I created a website and a Facebook page, and I spoke about it wherever I could speak, to groups as small as 7 to 8 people. And I was really trying to find a bigger organization to latch on to that had a similar mission and belief about the flag and what it can do for the city. So that organization is Greater Together, and it's a nonprofit here in Milwaukee that is trying to create avenues and pathways and put a big welcome sign on Milwaukee's creative industries, because as it is right now, our creative industries, which encompass not only design and advertising, but architecture and, even when we get down to some fine arts, it's very white and it's very male. And as we know, Milwaukee's a very diverse city. So we're trying to get in front of our youth, specifically kids of color, to show them that design and the creative industries are an option to make, you know, a professional job. And so our missions really aligned, and we partnered, and our partnership really allowed us to broaden the conversation. And we led design workshops all across the city at high schools, boys and girls clubs, middle schools and elementary schools, and even colleges where students are already studying design. So we were able to engage the public in a very authentic way where, you know, there's no money being exchanged, and the only thing that we're trying to do is to get them to think about, you know, what is the city that they live in? What are some things that make our history? And ultimately, what's the city we want for the future? What do we want to become? So that's really how it grew, and it was a very organic growth. And from there we tapped not only these kids in these workshops, but the general public as well through social media and a campaign. And we garnered over 1,000 flag design entries from the general public.
We're talking to Steve Kotas, driving force behind an effort to make a new Milwaukee city flag. And Steve, 1,000 entries, you're down to 5 now. We've got those linked on the Central Time Facebook page. The very striking thing, you look at those 5 versus the current flag, much simpler, much cleaner designs. Is that something you were hoping to get out of this process?
Of course it was. And we created a very succinct sort of creative brief in the form of a design kit, which is really just a PDF that we had on our website, which illustrated the 5 basic flag design principles. It gave forth some historical considerations to start from, geographical considerations, as well as examples of city and country flags that are considered to be very good. And so in return from the public, the bar was set really high, and I think that really speaks to the untapped talent of Milwaukee. And we had a judge that we flew in from Portland, and you can hear him as well in the TED Talk. His name is Ted Kaye, and he is a vexillologist, which is the vexillology is the study and the history of flags. And he really acted as our coach in the judging process. And he said multiple times when we finally got all 1,000-plus designs spread out, you know, he couldn't believe at the quality of the breadth of designs. Typically when a competition like this garners that many submissions, usually 800 are just, you know, kind of out. But we had our work cut out for us because they were all very good.
I love the word vexillologist. Yeah. That was a new one. Yeah. So that the study and history of flags. And looking again at Milwaukee's flag, so it sounds like it's still up in the air, pardon the pun, whether or not the winning flag would actually replace the current flag. The Common Council apparently would have to decide on that. But are you hopeful that they're going to consider this, Steve, as we wrap up?
I'm very hopeful. And, you know, we had an announcement on May 14th at City Hall. The mayor was there. The Common Council president was there. They announced to the finalists. So they're very aware of what we're doing, very supportive. But we've been given no 100% guarantee at this point in time that, yes, they're going to adopt the winning design. And you know, in a sense, so be it for now, because we've really positioned this and ourselves as the people's flag. And the city will continue for a time to have the city flag, and we will be making it possible for people to purchase and fly the people's flag. So I guess time will tell which one you start seeing more.
Steve, thanks a lot, and we'll watch for the unveiling of the winner on Tuesday.
Thank you so much.
That's Steve Kotas, design director and creative lead at the People's Flag of Milwaukee. You can check out the top five designs, the finalists in the contest. There's a link at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, it's getting hot outside, and not that we really need an excuse, but we're going to delve into the magical world of ice cream next as part of this week's Food Friday. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Getting hot inside, too, by the way. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about state job numbers, income taxes, and more in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, a bit of a heat wave is settling in this weekend in a lot of the state.
It's also a good excuse to eat your favorite frozen dessert when the weather heats up like this, whether maybe it's ice cream, frozen custard, or a popsicle. And for this week's edition of Food Friday, we're going to talk about ice cream and the history and the science behind it.
And we want to hear from you. What are your favorite flavors of ice cream, your favorite places to get ice cream or custard around the state? And do you make your own ice cream? How does it turn out? Can you share some with us right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment and find a recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
And joining us now is an ice cream expert. Maya Warren is a food scientist and frozen dessert expert for Coldstone Creamery and Pinkberry. She has her PhD from UW-Madison, and she's a familiar name to many people in Wisconsin after winning the Amazing Race. Maya, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And it's always, always a great excuse to talk about ice cream and, of course, eat ice cream. So I'm definitely happy to be back on. Thanks
right.
for having me.
And how did you get so into ice cream in the first place? What's your ice cream origin story?
You know, I was a chemist in undergrad. I went to Carleton College in good old Northfield, Minnesota, and fell in love with chemistry and wanted to be able to apply it in a more applicable way. And so I actually interned at Maltville Meal Cereal Company, which was right up the street from Carleton, and was not in love with grain, but loved food science. And I asked myself about, I was like 20 years old, you know, Maya, what do you love? And I was like, oh my gosh, I love ice cream. So I decided to go to University of Wisconsin-Madison and research under one of the great professors, Richard Hartel, in the area of phase transition and crystallization, which ice cream, of course, does. A phase transition occurs going from the liquid mix to the frozen product, and a lot of crystallization within the ice and the fat globules and all of that. So ended up at UW-Madison and thoroughly enjoyed my time. Cannot say I miss the winters too much, but I definitely do miss campus and the friends and professors that I have there.
Now, I would have guessed that ice cream history wouldn't go back that far. It depended on the invention of the freezer. Turns out, I guess I'm really, really wrong. Can you talk about the early origins of ice cream?
Yes, ice cream actually first started with just the concept of like ice or just having snow. And for instance, maybe putting like honey on it or some kind of sweetener or natural berries. So it started way before the freezer because we could have a frozen type product. Although at that time it wasn't whipped, it wasn't aerated, it wasn't in like a Carpigiani freezer or anything like that. So we definitely are fancy in terms of ice cream compared to the way that it used to be made. But there are concepts of ice. And then putting something on top of it is sort of where the origin started. And there's much debate, you know, did it start in China? Is it from Europe? You know, who was the first kind of ancestors, I guess, to create this product? And that's sort of still up for debate. But we can think of it as, okay, if there's snow, if there's a frozen product that then people started putting flavors or honey on top of, that then became later evolved into ice cream as we know it today.
Is there a particular moment where ice cream did sort of hit the public and people said, hey, this is a new thing, and everyone started eating it at once when it was maybe beyond the individual recipes or snow with honey that you talked about?
You know, I'm not actually 100% sure about how that all evolved. I know at some point in Italy, things became getting very popular, and eventually a man brought over from Italy to the United States this concept of ice cream, whatever it was at that point in time. And then eventually, you know, in America, things started popping up in the form of some type of frozen dessert, whether it was aerated, whether it was just a frozen kind of snow with something on top of it. And eventually we then started seeing, you know, shops that pop up, and eventually your fast food restaurants start coming, and then those fast food restaurants start serving soft serve. And, you know, nowadays how we have ice cream, how we enjoy it, and kind of what we know about it is has evolved so much from the beginning. And it's very, very interesting to see, especially like a lot of these artisan companies or brands come out with such new and unique flavors, as well as kind of how we experience the product. It's no longer just a bowl and a spoon. You know, it's like the waffle cone, or it's a flight of different frozen desserts, or it's more of in a popsicle form, or, you know, it just varies how we even experience it now. So it's not even kind of comparable to how we once used to eat quote-unquote ice cream to how we do it now.
When you talk about, you know, snow with honey on it or whatever, that's got the ice component, but it's missing the most important part in my book, the cream side of it. So what is it that makes dairy frozen dessert product so special and awesome?
So what one thing that makes it so special is that in the United States, we actually have a legal definition for ice cream. It has to have 10% or more milk fat, which is where the dairy component comes in. And notice that I said milk fat. So we often see these products on the market that may have, you know, soy milk or coconut milk or almond milk, or maybe not 10% milk fat in it. And the fat source may be coming from coconut fat, or it could be coming from some kind of vegetable oil or safflower oil, sunflower oil, you name it. Those aren't really considered ice cream. They're more of a frozen dessert type product. And I think what makes ice cream so special with having the milk fat component is the fact that we actually crave kind of that creaminess sensation or perception that comes as a result of that milk fat. And, you know, now I feel like the public is really embracing fat a little bit more than we used to. And I love that because I love fat in ice cream. And there's this phenomena called partial coalescence, which is like the agglomeration or the partial agglomeration, because they're not fully agglomerated together in the the sense that it becomes one globule, the partial agglomeration of fat globules that are hindered by a crystalline fat network. And that is there because of the milk fat properties in which the product is frozen, at which the product is frozen. And so milk fat is very dear to us. The more partial coalescence you have in your product, the more creaminess perception that you have. So when you have a sorbet, which is very general in the sense that it's sugar, it's water, and it's maybe a fruit puree or something like that, and it's frozen. But then when you add a milk component to it, you really bring a different texture, and it's a more of a smooth, more of a creamy sensation that occurs because you increase your total solids, you bring in fat and other ingredients, are the components of milk that really make the product what it is.
It's getting toasty outside, so we're talking ice cream today for Food Friday with Maya Warren. She's a food scientist and a frozen dessert expert for Cold Stone Creamery and Pink Berry, and she got her PhD in food science from UW-Madison. And Maya, so take us through a very basic ice cream recipe. At its most simple, how can we make a standard ice cream?
So, you know, making ice cream at home can be quite simple, but it also can be quite challenging. I recommend actually using heavy whipping cream and half and half, and not just using milk. One, because the heavy whipping cream and the half and half can bring in more fat, it can bring in more body, more texture to the product. And I also encourage people to use egg yolks. And the egg yolks actually act as emulsifiers, which help agglomerate those fat globules, as I had just mentioned, the importance of that fat agglomeration. But the egg yolk also adds a bit of body and texture to it. Sometimes, depending upon how much egg yolk you add to the recipe, you may have a little bit more closer to a custard. And, of course, in Wisconsin, we definitely know a lot about custards. And custards tend to be served fresh off. And actually, at home, a lot of people tend to make more custards than they do ice cream because they add egg yolk. And that egg yolk adds a lot of richness and can provide a lot more smoothness to the product. Of course, you have to add the sugar. I personally like my ice cream to be a little bit on the sweet side, so I may add a little bit more sugar than the normal, but about 2.5 cups of half and half, 2.5 cups of heavy whipping cream, about a cup and a fourth or so of sugar. I say about 8 to 10 egg yolks. Sometimes I do about 12, or sometimes I do about 6, depending upon the heaviness of the ice cream that I'm looking for. And then, you know, you put all of that in a pot, and you know, I'm hoping that we put up the recipe so people can see it. And then you can cool it, because of course you have to cook it and cook the egg and pasteurize it. Cool it, and then you can freeze it on one of your home freezers, whether you're freezing in a brine solution with rock salt and ice, or you're freezing in like a Cuisinart-type freezer where it's more of an electric freezer process, where you take the bowl that's been frozen in your freezer, the refrigerant inside is now cool and basically frozen, and then you can spin your ice cream that way. But then there's also, you know, ice cream in a bag that a lot of students do in their science classes. So there's a lot of different ways that you can do it, but I definitely recommend using the higher fat, making sure you use the heavy whipping cream, the half and half, and then also including that egg yolk. It may not be the smoothest product in the world because the length of time that it takes to freeze the ice cream at home, maybe about half an hour, 35 minutes or so, it's a bit longer than it is in industry. If you're at an artisan ice cream shop, they usually freeze the ice cream on a batch freezer, and those can be frozen in about, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. If you're getting a pint of ice cream that's from the grocery store, those have been frozen in a matter of about 1 to 2 minutes. So imagine 30 minutes of freezing and how those ice crystals can grow and grow over time. So I encourage people to make the ice cream, put it in the freezer, maybe put a bit of parchment paper over it so you can sort of help hinder some of that water migration via the airflow of the freezer unit at your home.
We're talking to Maya Warren, food scientist and expert on frozen desserts. She got her PhD in food science at UW-Madison, and we are talking about ice cream and custard, making your own, and just going out and eating it.
And we want to hear from you now that it's starting to get warm outside. Do you make your own ice cream? Do you have a favorite ice cream flavor? Any secrets, tips of the trade? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let us know if you have a favorite flavor anywhere around the state. 800-642-1234. More coming up, and maybe we'll hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Right now we're talking about ice cream on Food Friday. And we'd love to hear from you about this. Are you a big ice cream fan, or do you prefer maybe the Wisconsin specialty frozen custard? What is your go-to flavor? And any troubles making ice cream at home? Let us know. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Maya Warren stays with us. She can answer your ice cream making questions. She's a food scientist, got her PhD in food science at UW-Madison. Maya, vanilla ice cream tends to be the standby go-to. What are some easy flavors to experiment with if we want to move beyond the basic vanilla?
Oh, definitely. You know, I really, really, really encourage people to look at like maybe a jam or like a raspberry jam or maybe peaches. You know, fruits do very, very well, especially if you can, you know, sort of kind of baby them at home and saute them and add a little brown sugar and all of that. I'm a very, very, very big fruit person, but I'm also kind of the person that lives on the edge. I think a little bit of maybe avocado in there, a little habanero, actually does very, very well. So do beets. Beets actually pair very, very well with ice cream. And, you know, right now there's a lot of trends in kind of smoky flavors and spices. Recently, I was in New York for some business travel, and I tried a turmeric ice cream. And it was very, very, very good. And I also had a cardamom and a rose. So, you know, look at the pantry. Look at your cabinet and see what you have, see what kind of spices you have. You never know how they're going to pair. So I encourage people to try it and kind of live on the edge a little. But, you know, a basic vanilla is always good, and vanilla actually enhances a lot of different flavors. So if you're making chocolate, add a little vanilla to that so that it can enhance the chocolate flavor. Also, that sweet, salty kind of thing is really hot right now. So maybe a little sea salt in the vanilla, or a caramel, or maybe a burnt butter. Those are all really, really common flavors that are coming up in the market and that you'll really see, as well as some florals and some teas. So maybe a lavender kind of tea, honey tea flavor. But those are all things that people can try in small batches right at their home.
So Maya, when we're talking about ingredients like beets or sweet corn, say the Kirill here at WPR is a fan of sweet corn ice cream, does it become more like a savory accompaniment more than a dessert, or would you still call that a dessert? Does it still have sugar in it?
You know, I still call it a dessert because it still goes under the legal definition of ice cream. It still has a 10% fat. It still has, you know, a good amount of sugar, whether it's 12% or whether it's, you know, towards 14-15%. It still is an ice cream. But, you know, now society is more acceptable of the non-traditional, quote-unquote. So not just cookies and cream, not just Reese's or anything like that. You know, not just using the sweets with the sweets, but maybe pairing things that we tend to think of as more savory with the sweets. And so when we look at the corn or when we look at the beets, both of those naturally have a lot of sugars in them as well. So those really do tend to pair themselves very well with ice cream. But so does avocado, because of the amount of fat that avocado has in ice cream. So not just using your traditional fruits. I've also seen a lot of cilantro or basil or cucumber ice creams. And those can be very, very refreshing, because those are naturally already refreshing when we put them in beverages or anything of that nature. So, you know, I really, like I said, I really encourage people to just try the different things that are out there that you may have in your pantry, because you never know what may really pair well.
We surveyed some of our colleagues here at WPR, and a lot of them, surprised, like ice cream. Our news director, Noah Ovshinsky, says that he likes a vanilla chocolate chip ice cream. And that makes me wonder, you know, I like lots of chunks of different kinds of things, mostly chocolatey things in ice cream. When we're putting in those discrete solids in the ice cream making process, when do they go in?
Oh, definitely. So during the ice cream making process, especially when you're making them at home, you want to put in what we call particulates, which are those cookie pieces, those nuts.
It sounds so appetizing when you say globule in particulate.
So those particulates, which is what they're called, or we could just call them cookies and nuts and mix-ins. That's totally fine, too. But when we're making them at home, you want to let the ice cream firm up a little bit so you actually see ice cream and not just mix. So let it firm up a bit and have a few rotations, a few minutes of rotations of that dasher, that blade in the freezer. Let that rotate a little so you see kind of bulking of the product. That's actually the mix forming into ice cream as we know it. Those fat globules are agglomerating together. Those ice crystals are forming. And when that starts to happen, that ice cream can actually handle the bulkiness of additional things like chocolate chips or Oreos or pecans, cookie dough pieces, sprinkles, you name it. But if you're looking to maybe add a jam sauce or a caramel sauce or a little fudge into it and you want to add more of a ripple, I recommend waiting a little bit longer to add those because those are have a little bit of a sometimes thinner viscosity, and they can get mixed in too much until you don't have a ripple of chocolate anymore. Maybe you have what looks like chocolate ice cream. So in order to have that ripple effect, you want your ice cream to firm up a bit more, maybe 1 to 2 minutes before you're ready to take it out. Drizzle in some of that fudge or caramel or your honey or jam sauce and let that kind of variegate its way. It's called a variegate. Let that kind of variegate its way through and have a ripple effect in your product. My mouth is actually watering just thinking about
yeah,
it right
too.
Now.
Me too.
I'm like, I should go get some ice cream right now.
As soon as the show is over, you gotta wait.
Right. One thing that I also want to add to that, so say, you know, you're making a crisp at home and one of your favorite crisps that you want to put into your ice cream. I really recommend, you know, making your crisp and making sure you have maybe a little bit of oil that coats the outside of it. So then when you put it in your product, it won't get soggy as fast. Often when you know, may make ice cream at home and you're putting in different pieces of like bread type materials, whether it's a crisp or a cookie, that may not have an oil layer on the outside can get soggy in the product.
I want to take a caller now. We've got Tracy in Muskego who wants to join us. Tracy, hi.
Hi there, guys. How's it going?
Good, thanks.
I have just something to share that we do when we make ice cream. There's a method that we use, and I'm a preschool teacher, so I've done the plastic bag method at school as well, and that works great with little people. But I acquired something several years ago. It's called an ice cream ball, and it's actually a container that has like a cylinder in the middle where you put all your ice cream ingredients, and then on the outside you put your salt and your ice. And then it's got another seal on the other side. So then when you have all the ingredients in there, you toss the ball back and forth, and that mixes the ingredients inside, and it moves the ice around and everything. And it makes a really fantastic, quick, small amount of ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually get exercise when you're making this ice cream, Tracy?
Yeah, and it's funny. We take it camping with our family, too.
Oh,
you know?
Perfect. What a great idea. And
yes.
I mean, this is a small batch thing, but Maya, how about the ice cream ball method?
You know, I think it's great. I think it's great for, you know, a lot of kids to get involved in having a hand in making the ice cream. And it's fun. I mean, it's pretty much a brine solution on the outside, and it's a little barrel in the middle, then the ingredients inside of the barrel. So it's very similar to that brine solution that I previously described of rock salt and ice. I love it. You know, you can't make huge, huge quantities of it. That would be a lot of little ice cream balls, kicking back and forth. But I love it because it keeps people entertained, you know, and kids really do like it.
Tracy, thanks a lot for that call. Maya, as we start to wrap up, I know I can't ask you to pick one favorite flavor. That'd be too hard. But right now, you had to pick. You want to eat some ice cream. What do you want?
You know, right now, I want a good old candied buttered pecan that I make. It's very delicious. Actually, I call it double buttered candied pecan. It's pecans full of butter, lots of brown sugar, lightly salted with a little bit of sea salt, and the ice cream that I make has about 40% overrun, so not a ton of air added to the product, which is what overrun is, with a nice Madagascar bourbon vanilla and the buttered pecans in on top of it, and it's absolutely delicious. So that's what I could get. If I could make that right now, I would.
All right. Well, Maya, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you all.
That's Maya Warren. She's a food scientist and frozen dessert expert for Cold Stone Creamery and Pinkberry, and she got her PhD in food science from UW-Madison. You can still share your ice cream favorites and pick up a recipe, a basic frozen custard recipe, on the Central Time Facebook page. I've never made frozen ice cream or custard or any of that. You?
I have made it. We got it as a wedding gift, an ice cream maker, and So I was pretty into it for a while. I made raspberry sorbet and raspberry ice cream. For some reason, I was really into raspberries.
Yeah.
And I think we tried some mint stuff, too. It's a lot of fun.
So you need to break that out again and then start bringing in the things for
Clearly.
The Central Time team to test.
Or we could get the ice cream ball and we could toss it back and forth during the show.
Or in the office all day. We'd burn off like a tenth of the calories we got from eating the ice cream. Again, check out that frozen custard recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. This could be the end, period, full stop, of one of the most basic pieces of punctuation in our English language. The period, a.k.a. the full stop.
In a piece in the New York Times today, written almost completely without periods, by the way, language experts are saying that people are just not using periods very often anymore. We've got texting and quickie notes on Facebook that people just throw up there, and the period doesn't always seem necessary, people are saying, and sometimes also in Twitter, for instance, you know, it's obvious that your text is over. Why do you need a period? So I guess it's kind of going away.
And people see, and I see this too, the period can sometimes look surly. Like when I type emails to people, a lot of times I'm like, that seems so stiff and formal with periods. I'll throw in an exclamation point, even though that's not, you know, it's not like me, just to make it sound more fun and pleasant.
Your punctuation is a little surly now that you mention it.
Well, I mean, it reflects my personality, but I think I can disguise it in email with an exclamation point. And then sometimes this New York Times article referenced, if you text, somebody texts you the plan for the day, and if you say fine, period.
Then you sound surly.
Surly. You say fine, exclamation point, great, or fine. No.
Or fine, triple exclamation point.
Wow, you're really happy about that. So I don't know. This could be the end of those. I don't know. I think
that
books
makes me sad. I hope it's not true. I enjoy punctuation. I still use it in most of my texts. So I'm gonna keep using it.
Well, we're not stopping here on Central Time.